Thank you. My name is Andrus Kulikauskas. My talk is a structural semiotic study of how we use variables in mathematics and logic. And what I want to show is how I do cognitive investigations and how I think that can be very fruitful for all manner of subjects, including math and logic. And so one of the things that I am investigating is the way that we use variables. Because for students, it's extremely baffling. You know, it's a great mystery. And it's very surprising that it's something that is never really talked about very much. And what I want to show is that we can talk about it, and we can talk about it systematically. Okay, so an investigation is simply to collect the different ways we talk about them. And first I thought there would be maybe six, and then maybe six pairs. And it turned out I think there were 24 different ways. So this is work in progress. But an example would be very common is, you know, especially when you get to calculus, you'll have like for every epsilon greater than zero, there exists a delta greater than zero. And what that forces you to realize is that one variable, it could be arbitrary, or it could be particular, okay? A variable could be known, it could be unknown. It could be, especially in logic, it could be free, it could be bound. It could be specified, unspecified, dependent, independent. It could have a place, it could have a value. And there's more. It could be explicit, implicit. It could be a label or a letter. It could be typed or untyped. It could be output or input. It could be term or unit. It could be varying or constant. There's many different ways. The question is, maybe some of these are the same, maybe they're not, but how do we talk about this? So, and what you'll see, maybe I'll start with this, is when I started thinking about this and trying, and this is an exercise, this is a challenge. Try to explain to yourself what is going on here. So what I started to notice is that deep in the mind, when we look at these variables, sometimes they're sets, which means that they're all distinct, okay? But sometimes they're lists, which means they're ordered. And so, for example, when we work with vector spaces, it's not part of the axioms. But when you build a basis, there will be a first basis element, and there's a second basis element, and a third. And it almost doesn't matter, but that is intrinsically important part of vector systems, but absolutely not part of the axioms. So it's a nice example that there's something more than just axioms in math. Then there could be something I call a multiset. And all these are a little bit nebulous, but in math, what we mean by multiset is that you could have something that looks like a set, but with repeated elements. So there could be a 2 and a 2 and a 3 and a 3 and a 3 and a 4 and 6 and 6. That would be called a multiset. But in particular, I'm interested in the case where maybe there's only one element, but there could be many copies. So when we talk about existence, for example, there are many types of things, but there's one kind of existence, and everything is a kind of multiset with regard to existence. And then in math, we talk about an alphabet. An alphabet would be like the letters that we use, the symbols that we use. But in a certain sense, in math, there's a concept of a monad, which means that it's completely opaque. If, as far as I understand, there's no way to see what's going on. It's completely not related to anything else. It's in its own world. So sometimes it seems like there's only one object, or it's uncomparable to anything else. And that's the way we use letters. So let's look at some of these things. And I've been redoing these, so I can basically say that they're not certain. But what I want to happen, maybe, and what seems to possibly be happening, is that we're getting all pairs of these. And if you've noticed, these seem to naturally come in pairs. Okay, so a known and an unknown. So there's a little bit of a, well, why don't we do some examples and then we'll see what comes up. So for example, let's do specified and unspecified. So I can draw a graph, and it can have an x-axis and a y-axis and a z-axis. Those are all, but the values are unspecified. Then I can specify, you see, an x1 or an x2, an x3, x4. So what I'm claiming, when you have axes and they're unspecified, but the crucial thing is that x and y and z, their order doesn't matter, but they have to be distinct. So if y is unspecified, but it means it's different than x, it's different than z, but the y value is not in space. But when I say y1, you see there could be a y2, that y2 will be different. So, of course, these variables can very easily be transformed into a different situation, a different context, and so then everything will change. But that would be one idea, that would be one explanation of what is unspecified versus specified. When I talk about, let's say, another example here, free and bound, okay? So this isn't a perfect example, but here in Wikipedia it says that, well, H is bound, and H will go to 0, this will go to 0, this will go to 0, but you'll be left with an expression in X, and so the idea is that X is free. Now, I think that very much depends on what level you're thinking at, because in another level you'd say, well, no, there's more than one X, so if there's more than one X, it's not free. So I think from a logical point of view, that would be arguable. But in either case, but so if we understand that concept, then maybe this isn't the perfect example, but it's a nice example because it shows that the same example can be looked at different ways. But if we have this notion of freeness and boundness, when we say bound, that means that these are different instances of the same thing. But when we say free, it means that it should probably be like why. Why is free? And why is doing its own thing? And why doesn't care about anything? And why is unrelated? And there may be a Z, but they're all living in some kind of alphabet, and they just don't participate, and they don't care. So free and bound would be between alphabet and multiset. Arbitrary in particular, so when we say for every epsilon, I am claiming that epsilon is in that kind of alphabet world. Epsilon doesn't really need to have a value. This, I'm epsilon, what are you going to do? See, but the delta is a particular delta. It's being chosen, and it's in a set. It doesn't really need to be the first or the second. There's not going to be more deltas, let's say. But this is a set, and it's a particular value in that set. So there needs to be a set. Known and unknown. So here, we could have, if I put it on the inside, it doesn't really matter, but if I put it on the inside, the unknown could be on the inside, the known could be on the outside. I thought about it, I think originally I had it the other way, but then the more I thought about it, see, when you have a bunch of knowns, but they are like all one mass of known, but there could be a set of unknowns that you're solving for. But really, kind of like all the knowns are really just participating in one knownness, you know, one being, let's say. So, and see, do you see how tricky it is? Like, there's four levels going on. It's very easy to get lost, because there could be many knowns, but that's not issue. There is one sense of knownness. But there could be several unknowns. That's the claim. Dependent and independent, you see, there's these subtle issues. So I think that dependent, you see, why did I decide to put it here? Because you can have a first dependent, and then it's part of a bigger dependent, and then it's part of a big, you can have a whole chain and hierarchy of dependencies. So they seem ordered. But the independence, the idea is, you know, I'm partly making this work, but you may have independents that are distinct, but they're all going back to a basic sense of freeness and independence, and you can call them different names, but at the deep point, at this point, it doesn't really matter because they're independent. We don't know them. They're independent. So that could be argued. And then here's an interesting one, a place and a value. So again, originally I thought, well, and I decided that the place, you see, what these indexes are doing, like for a matrix, is they're creating a space. But in that space, each slot has a value, but that value is functioning like this type of alphabet. So this is a strange way to think about these things. We don't usually compare them. But the main point I'm trying to show, this is particularly interpreting me wrong, but we're able to understand something. That's very strange. And that there is some kind of cognitive set of choices. And I don't think it's much bigger than this. You know, I mean, there may be different cross sections or whatever, but there's something very strong about this. Yes?
What is the subtle distinction between alphabet and set here? Because you're
right,
isolated and have distinct. But
so when and these are all sort of distinct. But in the case of a set, I'm saying that let's say there's an x axis and a y axis and a z axis, and they're all distinct, and the distinctness matters. You see?
Yeah.
And it matters because I need to keep track. I guess, well, that's not a good enough reason. It matters that they be distinct. But you see, when I have an alphabet like in a sequence, so maybe I'll go to the other slide. Here's a letter in a sequence, right? And I'm saying, this letter doesn't really care about those other letters. It's in its own world. You see, that's like a mass. It's just distinct from that mass. It's not participating with them. It just, it's autistic. Does that make sense? So maybe it's not very clearly specified, but there is a distinction there. And of course, you don't have to make that distinction. So you could have a philosophers, of course, or metaphysicists. No, no, no. But I'm trying to say, if we're asking what's going on here, then that's a helpful concept.
And you have also used monads here instead of elements here,
right? Right. So letters. That's a new thing I've been learning from category theory. But I think the idea of a monad is that it's opaque. You don't know what's inside. So you can have a system that is completely.
Did you take this from
The category theorist took it from Leibniz. I took it from the category theorist. So, okay. I haven't read Leibniz on that. So, or maybe not at all. And now here's another thesis. So I got more of these, and we'll go through them. But see, the nice idea is that, you see, here, all of these are for creating problems. Because all of these are adding information. They're making things richer. They're making things more specified. So you go from free to bound. If you just have free things, there's no problem. But if you make them bound, it becomes interesting. So that if they're arbitrary, it's not interesting. But you make them particular, it becomes interesting. If they're all known, it's not interesting. But the unknowns are interesting. If it's unspecified, it's not interesting. But when you specify, it's interesting. If it's independent, it's not interesting. Dependent is interesting. If the value is not interesting, but it's the matrix that makes them interesting. See, this would be hard to get. But this is kind of confirming that this seems to be on the right track. But this is all creating problems, and then the opposite would be, well, how do you solve them? So then you have to go in the backwards direction, I think. So there's this distinction between explicit and implicit, so everything's away. But there's a unique explicit thing, right? But there's only one of them. So that explicit thing could be participating elsewhere, let's say, in other equations. But it would be multiple. I'm kind of, this is work in progress, so don't take me very seriously. But here, you can have a letters in a sequence like generated by an automaton. But see, when you label a diagram, it's different. Because the relations become different. You can't confuse them. You have to. Types and untyped, I don't have an example of that, and that's more of a computer science type of thing, and I think I just threw it in here. Maybe I won't even discuss that. Input and output. The type, as I said, would mean you can say a variable is an integer, or you can say you don't care. You're underspecified. And so maybe what this is saying is that one way to solve problems is you go from, I don't know if this would be, you treat the labels as letters, let's say. That could help you solve a problem. Or you type things. That could help you solve a problem. Input and output, I'm saying, I guess there could be different inputs, but the outputs would be generating an order. So that makes sense. The inputs have to be distinct, but because this could be of composition, then the outputs would be upon outputs upon outputs. A term and a unit, so you can use symbol. Yes?
No.
You can use a symbol, like a meters could be a unit, and I tell my math students, I go, every answer has an amount and a unit, and if you don't know the unit, so it could be, the answer could be 100 meters, but it could be 100x, but it has an answer and a unit. Well, that's from physics. It could be a term, okay? And then it could be varying or constant. So maybe I'll just say this is just an investigation. But I want to say that it is very powerful. And I want to link it up to some other things then. And so this is what I've basically told you. But I think there's a deep structure in the mind, like cognitive structures. And I've worked on this. You worked on your things from your youthhood. So I also, 35 years ago, I said there's these divisions of everything. So for existence, you need two points of view. You need to be able to say, maybe this exists, maybe it doesn't. There's a question. But if it exists, then it exists. It's an answer. And so like free will and fate, you get these, and people argue about these things, but it's kind of crazy to argue about them. There's these cognitive structures that we need both. That tells you right away existence is not primitive, because existence requires two points of view. For participation, for learning, for the scientific method, you need three points of view. You take a stand, you follow through, you reflect, you do a cycle of it, so you have a hypothesis, you do your experiments, you look at the results, etc. You have this cycle of participation. And I'm saying for knowledge, you need four points of view. Whether, what, how, why. Now, materialists will focus on the whether. They think that's the most real. And so the typical example would be like a bottle, right? What would be the form, the sensory thing? How would be the blueprint, how it creates and uses things? Whether would be if we hid it in that... and no one saw it, is it still there? You see, we can't talk about it. We can't experience that. This is so stupid. But you see, but we can think about that. And why would the, if we knew how everything relates to that bottle, then we'd have to know how we got into this room, and we would have to know, you know, what is China, and we'd have to know about the story of your logic, and we have to know everything, because it all relates to this bottle here, right? So that's why. That's like the Yoneda lemma. It says that if you know all the relations, then you basically understand the system. So these things appear in all contexts, but in semiotic stuff, you can immediately understand the types of theorems. So an icon, like, so here has this beautiful, very useful distinction of signs. And he said he has, like, an icon would be a cat that's a picture, let's say. So here's a cat. I think that's a cat, right? My cat. That's a picture, that's an icon. But you see, if we have a dead mouse, that's also a sign of a cat. But that's a cause and effect relationship. So that would be an index. You have to think on a different level for that. And if we had the abstract letter CAP, well, that's a symbol, you would call it. It has just, you would have to be the total genius god to understand how this relates to the cat. It's completely arbitrary. But he doesn't talk about the thing itself. There's always the thing itself. So there's four levels. Now, if you look at Gramus, he has the semiotic square. And you could say, let's say, well, you could say, I know everything. Or you could say, I know nothing. And not nothing is anything. And not everything is something. And you know all these things. So if you know everything, that's the why. But if you know anything, that's like a how. If you know something like that cat, that's a what. And if you know nothing, like whether anyone can see the bottle, that's nothing. And this nothing, knowing nothing is very interesting because formal systems are all knowledge about nothing. They don't make sense. So truth is very sharp about nothing. It's true or it's false or whatever. But it's just silly because it's about nothing. See, truth's about everything. All things are true about everything. So you can say everything is hot, and everything is cold, and everything is good. See, it's all trivially true. Because there's no internal structure to latch on. So there's these distinctions. So there's these deep structures. And then I want to maybe conclude to show how those variables fit into a bigger epistemological system. And I'll give you this problem. This is like Chomsky. So we have like linguistics here. And let's do this math proof. So I've studied the way of figuring things out, and especially like in mathematics. And Euclid has a famous problem. He says, look, take this line segment and build an equilateral triangle from it. And I'll give away the trick. The trick is that you draw two circles and you see where they intersect. It's a beautiful trick. But if you didn't see that trick, I don't know how you would do it. It would be hard to get perfect the triangle. But what I want to say is like this is the surface structure issue. But how did we solve this? You see? And George Pollier has a beautiful book, How to Solve It, and he talks about the pattern of two loci. But it's really the pattern of two conditions. There's condition A, means that the point will have to be on this circle, and condition B means it will have to be on this circle, and there's the both conditions, and there's neither conditions. And that is a lattice. And that lattice is in the brain. Lattice is not acclimatized in the brain. It just works. So that shows what natural math is. I mean, I look at math, and it seems so contrived. You know, it seems like they're just so non-real, you know. This is real. So I said, how can you, so it gives you a way to distinguish between what math is real and what is just for fun, right? Or for PhD thesis or whatever. So, and this is, but this is real. And so there's a whole system. It turned out I just looked at 200 examples, and there's a system of 24 things. It's very beautiful. So, and if you know those building blocks, you see those cognitive building blocks, you can start to see them. But, so in algebra is what? You can have the center of a problem. Right? If you write the right, correct center will solve the problem. You can have balance or parity, which means like you multiply by one, the numerator and denominator match, or add zero, you know, plus and minus, that'll solve the problem. Polynomials you can have where like it expands or factors out, and a vector space. You can have a vector space in the mind that solves the problem. Now this vector space is in some mystical sense the vector space. It's saying that things can be independent or dependent, etc. But how that's axiomatized in the brain, I don't know, but it's certainly not axiomatized. And that's all working with one sheet in the mind. Okay, so if the mind works on one sheet, that's algebra. Analysis is when you have many sheets. So you could have like a, you could do induction on an infinite sequence of sheets. You could have a post, let's say, but with maximal or minimal elements, so you find the maximum. You could have least upper bounds or greatest lower bounds, and I think that's, I'm learning that's what adjunct functors are in category theory. And you could have limits, like infinite limits. Okay, but and this same model, it works for, there's a, like basically Chomsky's universal grammar for language is really, I gave a talk yesterday, it's a universal grammar for games. If I studied, I did a study of 80 Silicon Valley innovation games, and each game had a purpose, you get the exact same structure, because you get games within games, you get games to start games, you get games to end games, you have this learning cycle here, that's inside the game. So the learning cycle for math would be, you take a stand, you follow through, reflect. You take a stand, you extend the domain. So when I teach my students, I take something like 2 cubed times 2 squared equals 2 to the fifth, that formula, 2 to the x times 2 to the y equals 2 to the x plus y. And I say, okay, but what would it mean for 0? We're going to extend the domain. And it's for, see, the concept of extending domain is not some kind of magic. It says, look, if you want to extend the domain, it will have to be 1. 2 to the negative 1 will have to mean this. 2 to the 1 half will have to mean this because you're extending the domain. So that's taking a stand. Following through is continuity arguments. You can have two different states, and you can show that if you do a continuity argument, you'll get a critical point, let's say. And then self-superimposed sequences, when we do algebraic combinatorics, we take a sequence, and then it may superimpose on itself, and you get the relationship. So this kind of sews together algebra and analysis, and it yields a symmetry group. So symmetry group is kind of like the solution. And this is all pre-systemic mathematics. The very start is independent trials, which says that you can work on a problem, throw it out, and start a new problem, etc., etc. So it's important for statistics to say we can have lots of independent trials. But once you have a system, then you have a logic and a metalogic. You have like two sheets, a sheet for your logic and a sheet for your metalogic. They can be the same sheet. So that's the case here. This is when you have the same sheet, metalogic and metalogic. The theme. This is the icon they spread out. This is the index. And this is the symbol. This is saying, like, this is totally separate from the original thing you're modeling. So similarly, we have four types of logics or geometries. I'm guessing, I think that these would be affine, projective, thank you, affine, projective, conformal, and simplectic. But the point of these is that you have truth by contradiction. If you have logic and metalogic thing, then you can have modeling. You can make a model. So the model could be a tiny little model of the bigger problem. That's a way to solve something. You could have implication where you work backwards for your solution, and you can have variables. So the variables say if you separate these four levels, you can do all the things we talked about. Okay, that's the variable input. And then you can have six combinations. So these are syntactic structures. So you enter a game by asking a question. You leave the game by getting an answer. Okay. But if you want to stay in the game, you answer the question with question. So syntax develops here. It's questions and questions. So like a question could be like, am I a robot? You know, and the counter question could be, well, would it make any difference? You see. So that's the way you play these types of games. And here in math, you get this system of things like factoring, things like the power set lattice of conditions that we had, adjacency graphs, directed graphs for cycles, extensionality, total order. And then the final thing is that when you have all these, and these are visual, I gave a talk on visualizations and paradoxes, because each visualization is really just a restructuring, like of a tree, a sequence, a hierarchy with a second tree or sequence or hierarchy, and there's a gap in between. And that gap means you can play a game within the game. So in linguistics, you can always kind of pause and do something in the middle. And so in math, what that means, it means like if I ask you, what's 10 plus 4? Who can tell me? 10 plus 4. Yeah. 10 plus 4 equals?
It's like
16
or something.
14? Then I'll say I could say you are wrong because the answer is 2, because I'm thinking of a clock, you see, and 10 o'clock plus 4 o'clock is 2 o'clock. Does that make sense? So even the most obvious thing, 10 plus 4, I just want to say, is not clear what it means. The context can never be clearly specified. Does that make sense? Like someone writes down 10 plus 4, we have no idea what they really mean unless we guess the context. So that's the final, where this all leads to, and then you can create new games. And so I think that's, so maybe to conclude, the axioms of Zermelo-Frankel set theory seem to relate to all these six, and six of them are these visualizations. So like if you have regularity at unique cycles, you have these order CSS. But the remaining four, if you have an empty set and a scheme of replacement and a scheme of specification, I think that seems to match what we have. So like list would be in a version of infinity, that the monad would be the empty set, and then the idea would be that the sets would be domains, and then ranges would be the same, like math cares about sets, they need to be keep distinct. The range we don't care about, it's just a blob. So that's just showing that there's this this very brief tour of a very cognitive world that we live in, and the reason people don't pursue this since the days of Kant, etc., is because they don't believe in absolute truth. So, but I think if we tried a little harder, I think, you know, this certainly can be experimentally pursued. That's my work in progress.
Thank you. If you have questions?
Yes.
Do you know the analysis of the ambiguity of variable by Curie?
But Curie?
Curie.
You know, I hear about that, but I don't. Maybe you could explain it because I don't really understand Curie.
The introduction of his book on continental logic, and for him, it is very important to distinguish the ambiguity of variable, and he constructs a combinatorial logic to resolve in part of this problem.
So his last name is Curie.
Curie, Haskell Curie.
Haskell Curie.
It is a big logician, American logician. And it is a creator of combinatorial logic.
Okay, so I need to study that and try
and it is important, very important for him to analyze the ambiguity of variables. And it is
it's a practical compatible. Is it compatible? Okay.
Compatible, you,
so the independent.
Yes.
Is this convincing or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Second remark in. Unfortunately, in the presentation of logic, for instance, an actual deduction of Jensen, we have not different notation for the elimination of the quantifier, universal quantifier, for instance, for all I as I, we eliminate the quantifier. F ice. Ice is a quelconque, whatever.
Right.
Yes. But we
so for all x, f of x, all of, for
all
for every x, f of x, if for every x is the quantifier, and f of x, and x is whatever, like you say.
It is all a very object of the expression. But in elimination of existential quantifier, we exactly the same notation, but not the same meaning, because if here is the I, such as MI, FY, FI. But in this case, I, so the variable, is not whatever, is not any. It is an unspecified object of the
but it exists. Is that the So maybe the last thing I would just add, just to respond to that, is that when you build these, you can imagine like a god, basically, and he's differentiating everything into parts. He's a state of contradiction. And he's saying, look, how do I create a state of non-contradiction? So he perceives. And so the final, you know, division to five would be for time and space and decision making. For six would be for morality. But for seven is logic. And the way logic looks, I will have to draw on this. Maybe that's not wrong. You have like for all x and then for all x not, let's say, and then exist x, exist as not. And you have these three sides, you see? And that's seven. See, and what I want to say is that there's a crucial difference. When you say all x, the system could be empty. But when you say all x and x, it is not empty. You see? So that's the thing. Logic needs all seven. And when you add the eighth, you get all x and all not x, and the whole system is empty and it collapses. That is why, see, that is why the mind is a finite system. Because it says eight, it's like it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then when you push it over, it collapses and it can start again. So we live in a little tiny. That's how.
But I'm sorry.
If we eliminate the bound variable, mm-hmm. we have not this problem in the presentation of quantitative relative judgment given by Curie.
So I hope we can talk and continue. Thank you so much.
I have a remark also. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting, but in the math.